Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, nice, the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Welcome to Dr. Creepin's Dungeon. The world of horror. It shows us that the control we think we have is but an illusion, and that every moment we teeter on chaos and oblivion. 5 tales of terror for you this evening, and we begin with The Council of the Black Woods by Ryan Brenneman. Now before we begin, as always, a word of caution. Tonight's tales may contain strong language, as well as descriptions of violence and horrific imagery. If that sounds like your kind of thing, then let's begin.
There's a calling among the woods, whispered among the whispers of the midnight breeze. A calling, hushed and wary, that beckons to a cabin settled within the snowy mountains, at a lowly place surrounded by a mob of white firs and pines. A dreary shack, with walls of rot and full of holes. A truck sits idle outside, its engine cold and its cab empty. Headlights flicker, their strength wavering in long, struggling breaths that dance across the west side of the cabin. A snow shovel rests on the porch. A cool crimson creeps down its handle, dripping into the snow. Although the blinds are closed tightly, and both the front and back doors are locked shut, they can't conceal the sounds, the horrors committed within that house. The sharp scraping of a table's feet against a naked wood floor. A deep, throaty moan, indistinguishable of pleasure or pain. And a wet sound, almost reminiscent of pigs feeding from within a trough. All of this, over the light, cackling sounds of a gentle, healthy fire. These sounds continue for some time. They are ravenous, feasting sounds. As the wind blows through the trees, blowing snowflakes into flight, gifting the dark with their chilling splendor, the noises start to falter. They fade and the snow drifts towards the ground, falling between the dark. It is then, in that silence, that the whispering quickens, hastening to utter a lonely name. They beckon. They call. Dakota Black. The front door flies open, and the man, Dakota Black, stumbled onto the porch, melting the snow beneath his fingertips with the warmth of blood, his and someone else's. It covers his arms and hands, his chest and his face. It encompasses his mouth, smeared like jam. His sin sticks between his teeth, and he leaves the porch like a drunkard, barely managing to grab onto the snow shovel before he does so. He trips over his own shame and fear, landing face first into the fresh snow. He lets the shovel lie. Bites into him like 100 greedy mouths, but he doesn't care. He shudders, but not from the cold. He is afraid because he is watched. He is afraid because they're here too soon. The whistling he hears is not the wind, but the breathing and wheezing of ancient, frigid nostrils. He needs not see them to know. This isn't how he envisioned their meeting. He isn't happy. Still, he prostrates himself, face down in the snow. He spreads out his arms and legs. He is vulnerable, but he's left unharmed. He rises, as they allow, but only to his knees. In frightful reverence, he keeps himself humble before them. Before the council of the Black Woods. He knows their true names, but he doesn't dare think it.
He buries the thought in his mind, buries it deep, beyond the hope of light. There's only one which sees initially, but he knows there is not only one. It exists like a nightmare, unfitting for the physical world. It's faceless, skinless. Its skull, like the head of a deer, sits atop broad shoulders. It doesn't shine in the moonlight. It's grey like winter, hollow. The rest of its form hidden behind a nightmare cloak crafted of skin, human skin. Human faces torn and stitched together, like the patches of a quilt. From within the heavy cloak, a skeletal hand emerges, gesturing forth, and the terrible whispering said to him, "Never." Was he to respond? How? He has not a clue as to whether the creature before him mocked or whether it was a simple inquiry. His rage has decided for him. Adrenaline seizes his hands, and he pulls clumps of grass from beneath the pool of snow. And he screams. He screams into the night, releasing his pain, his guilt, his fear into the frozen sky. He frees his hands and brings them to his face, feeling it as though he were blind. He rounds his cheeks and pinches his ears. He claws at his nose, and his fingertips glide across his chapped lips. He is unchanged. He is Dakota. That isn't good enough. "Why?" he asks. Born of the ink in the woods, the council bleed into the night. Dakota beholds them with a horrid, wanting lust. Such a horrid majesty, he thinks, his eyes feasting upon them. What splendid variety. A beast scampers across the ground. It's naked, like a man, but it is so clearly not. Spikes blister the skin, particularly down its spinal column. Its fanged jaws hang agape, and not by choice. It is seemingly broken, rendered useless. The torn flesh by the corners of its mouth seem to confirm that theory. Like an ape, it clings low to the earth, only stopping every so often to readjust its damaged jaw. It looks young. Another creeps out on stilt-like legs, walking forward on all fours. Pairs of antlers sprout all the way from the base of its human skull, across its sloping shoulders, and across its mud-caked backside. Its true face hides behind an emotionless white mask. Dense branches snap like frail kindling as one behemoth emerges from the woods, snow nearly invisible as it falls across its matted white fur. As tall as a shack, and with a girth as wide as his truck, it stood indomitable above all the rest, red eyes blazing. One hangs from within the trees, clinging to the bark with all four arms. Its eyes glitter yellow like fetid stars. Another looks like a wildebeest, or perhaps a buffalo, that learned to stand on two legs. It clambers through the snow on bulky legs with arms so long they graze the snow. Its eyes, like those of a shark. Solid, ebony, and unfeeling. "Why so many?" he asks. "They all wanted to see." Another creeps low, body of tattered, rotting fur. Another stalks the perimeter, only its hooved legs are visible. Its torso is covered by the black. And then there's the one that steps out of the cabin, from behind Dakota. He wants to rise, but he knows he can't. He restrains himself even as the thing towers over him. Its face used to be human. They all used to be human. It drops something beside him before returning to the council. Something heavy. Blood splatters. Red constellations across an ivory sky. It's the other man. A large, portly man. Glazed brown eyes. His gut torn asunder, as if ravaged by wild dogs. The young one, the one with the broken jaw, starts whimpering. It's anxious, gaunt and hungry. It slavers red. Dakota no longer pays attention, not to the council. He drools as well. The body, his sin, has been returned to him. Perhaps there's another chance. With the council watching, he feeds once more. He shreds, tears, pries without remorse, without care. He does so until his body betrays him, and the pain in his lungs is too great. He feels like he's drowning in dry air. He coughs in a fit, spraying blood. He falls over, hoping this is it. He hopes the pain he feels inside is no longer the cancer. He wonders if, now, he'll start to change. But normality is restored. He can breathe again through an aching throat. He hates it. His body feels like dying, but he will not allow it. Through great, heaving breaths, he rises from the ground, daring to stand before them. It's an insolence that riles the council, all of them showing physical signs and sounds of disgust, except for the one in the cloak of faces. "What do you want from me?" he shouts at them, arms outstretched. It has become too much for the young one, impatient and inexperienced, to bear. He lunges forward, ready to devour, but Dakota doesn't hesitate. The shovel is lifted from the snow and the broad, metal head meets the creature in its gut. Dakota angles the hit downwards, delivering the beast to the frozen earth. There, it flails, only for a minute, before Dakota brings the shovel down again and again. The beast cries for help, but none of the others assist it. They're intrigued. They watch. Time and time again, with furious screams, Dakota brings the metal shovel to the creature's pale flesh. Spikes snap like bone, but Dakota decides it's not enough. The shovel isn't heavy enough to do real damage, so he starts stabbing, slicing with the shovel's thin, sharp edge. It isn't hard to cut into the creature's paper-like flesh. It wails, and the shovel breaks. Dakota doesn't stop. He beats the creature with what's left, clubbing him with the shattered staff. His screaming doesn't die even as he starts stabbing the quickly fading beast with the splintering edges of the handle. He stabs and stabs, long after the creature has stopped moving. Panting, he looks to the others, uncaring for their silence. "What more do you want?" he asks, his legs feeling weak. "What more could you possibly need? You really want this?" He feels the terminal pain rising in his chest. The air, the poison. "My dad told me the tales," he mutters. "He told me what it would cost. Immortality." "What cost?" Dakota looks at the mangled corpse. He has fed. "A great, great cost for desperate men." The creature in the cloak of faces steps forward, moving lightly across the snow. The others around the perimeter seem to do the opposite. They retreat backwards, just a hair, just a step. The one with the cloak stands not a meter from Dakota's face, and although it has no eyes, Dakota knows it can't look away. It is confused. It is scared. And Dakota doesn't know why. "Flesh," he hears it whisper. "From somewhere within the cloak is the cost of desperate men. A ticket for a spirit to enter. To turn and mold a degraded body and a weakened soul that has partaken in the unforgivable. To sever an irreparable connection between vessel and spirit. Only when weakened, can a soul, can a body be properly molded?" Dakota takes a step closer, daring to stand face to face. "Are you saying I'm not worthy?" The creature tilts its head. "You are." Dakota swallows his fear. "Well, then why?" "Because you are strong." Dakota can't stop shaking. His fists clench. "I need to be one of you," he demands. Make me one of you.
One of us, it asks. Say it.
The creature rounds him, moving around him clockwise. It whispers.
What do you want us to make you?
He gasps as he says it, as the creature places its skeletal palms upon his shoulders.
Wendigo.
The night pauses. The wind dies. The moon dims in the sky. The council has faded. All except for the one that whispers in his ear.
No.
The cloak opens wide, and before he can say a word, Dakota is pulled inside.
Into the black.
Now, in these challenging times, a lot of us men have let our personal grooming routines slacken a little bit. And it's okay, because now is the time to get back into a nice routine. And I'm here to help you do that with Manscaped. Manscaped is dedicated to helping you level up your full body grooming game with a Perfect Package 3.0 kit. Which comes with the Essential Lawnmower, 3.0 waterproof cordless body trimmer, and loads of other liquid formulations to round out your grooming routine. What's more, inside the Perfect Package, you'll also find the Manscaped Crop Preserver and Crop Reviver, special deodorant and toner to spray on and make sure you're smelling majestic before your Tinder date. Even better, with the Perfect Package or Performance Package purchase, you now get two free gifts, the shared travel bag and the patented high-performance, reduced-chafing Manscaped boxers. There is no better time than now to get back into your full-on grooming routine. You get 20% off plus free shipping at manscaped.com when you use the code CREEP, C-R-E-E-P. So do yourself a favor and always use the right tools for your bush trimming experience. So that's right. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code CREEP at manscaped.com. One more time, that's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com. Just use the code CREEP, C-R-E-E-P. It's 2021 and you still got bush? Well, change that now with Manscaped. Our next story is, every night armed thieves come to our village. One night they stop coming, by Aralmin.
I live in a village in a small country in Eastern Europe. The area is very rural, mostly farms and houses. To the distance you can see a mountain range, and to the opposite side is the highway. Our area has never been developed. Every call to the government to fix the infrastructure goes to deaf ears. There aren't any streetlights, and most of the houses are connected by gravel roads, which I suppose is an improvement to the dirt roads we used to have. I suppose partly the fact that the area is unheard of, and partly the fact that it's remote, and partly the fact that no one is armed, is what made the place enticing to thieves. I live with my family in a small house. There are five of us, my parents and my siblings. Everyone in the village knows each other, but I'm only close to four of them. One night, while I was helping my family with farm work outside, it was getting dark, and I could hear shouting and yelling a little ways off. I wondered what the commotion was about. A little bit later, one of my close neighbors, John, was running and shouting, saying thieves had come and taken his livestock. So a group of us had gathered with whatever improvised weapons we could get and headed to John's property. All we could find was a broken fence and empty pens. After this incident, nothing happened for the next few days, and we hoped it wouldn't happen again. Oof. We were very wrong. I was about to go to sleep on one particular night when I heard sounds outside. I went outside to see what was happening, and I could see, not too far off, on one of the neighbor's houses, there were four dark silhouettes. It appeared like they were carrying something. I went back outside, and I went to wake my family. All of them were groggy and annoyed that I'd woken them. I told them to stop making noise, because the thieves had returned. They all got up, especially my dad, and went to find a shovel as we all huddled next to the window to see what was happening. Suddenly we saw a shadow pass by the window, and it sent a chill up my spine. It was one of the robbers, and he was armed. He was dressed in all black, including a balaclava to cover the face, and was carrying a rifle. We watched helplessly as he looked around, going from house to house. He stopped at one of the houses and motioned with his arm as several others dressed in the same manner and armed came to the spot. We saw them hauling several items, mostly garden decorations, and also a few chickens. When they left, we could see in the distance some lights turning off and heading towards the highway. After this incident, it just became a regular occurrence. Sometimes they would come every night, sometimes they would come every few days. Well, we called the police, and when they showed up, they'd stay a while, but then leave. They didn't know who was doing it, but they couldn't afford to stay there for long. We asked them desperately if they could leave patrols in the area every night. It would only be a matter of time before they broke into someone else's house. We called anyone we could. News agencies, investigative reporters, anyone in the media, just so we could get word of what was happening. Finally, someone came from one of the investigative journalism shows on TV to report on the area. They interviewed the people and told us that they would go and ask the police department about the thefts. We thanked them as we told them that they'd been the only ones to try and help us, and no one else was bothered. Some of us suspected that the local police themselves were involved. We didn't know what to do, but when we began to organize ourselves and would post sentries throughout the village, they had let us know if the thieves were there. We also began to fortify the houses with whatever we could to keep the thieves at least from coming in. Things, though, went back to usual as the thieves kept coming back. This time we saw that they were trying to break into our next-door neighbor's house. It belonged to Mark, one of our close neighbors. It's directly across from us. We were scared. They tried with whatever they could to break the door, but nothing was working. Mark had barricaded all his doors. Then one of them aimed at the door with his rifle and fired several rounds, and then continued to try to break in, but he wasn't budging. He put something really tough in place. And finally, they gave up. They looked around and saw our house. We prayed they wouldn't come, but they did. They did the same thing, trying to knock down our door. They didn't know it, but days earlier, me and my siblings had helped our dad brick up the doors, so if they tried to break the door, all that would be waiting for them would be a brick wall. They tried everything they could, but nothing was working. Frustrated, the thieves fired several rounds into several houses and then left. The next day, all the people gathered in the village. We knew things were going to get even worse at this point, and it was time to make a decision. We could stay and try and hold them off, or leave. Some of us didn't even wait around, just gathered their belongings and left. My father had decided that we would stay. We pleaded with him to leave. Someone might get killed, but he insisted on staying. There was nowhere that we could go anyway. We ended up being among the few people that had decided to stay. Hearing that we had, our close neighbors asked us if they could come and join us. Mark, Peter, David, and John, along with their families. We agreed, and at least we would all feel safer together. When night fell, we all got quiet as we listened for anything. Tonight it seemed like the world had gone mute. All we could hear was one of the wind chimes from John's house moving with the wind, making things that much more eerie. We waited and waited, but nothing. I wanted to stay up, but sleep was getting the better of me. I was awoken by the most blood-curdling scream I'd ever heard. After that, we heard several shots. We went to see what was happening, but all we could see was the black truck that the thieves usually came in, speeding towards the highway. We waited for an hour, and finally agreed to go see what had happened, but only five of us, John, Mark, Peter, David, and my dad, went out, armed with shovels and steel pipes. We waited for them to come back. Finally, when they did, they said they couldn't find anything. All they could find was blood on one of the pens. My dad told everyone there to stay until the morning, and after that it would be safe to leave. No one disagreed. When morning came, all of our neighbors went to inspect their houses. Some of them had been broken into and looted. I asked my dad where he'd seen the blood, and he showed me the spot. It was in the pens where the neighbors keep the animals. It didn't make sense. Why would they shoot the animals? We wondered who'd scream like that, because it was the most unnatural scream I'd ever heard. For the next few days, we'd all huddle up in our house, including our neighbors, and waited out until morning. Nothing seemed to happen. After the third day, one of the neighbors that had left came into the village and asked us what was going on. He was so scared that the thieves would come into his house that he'd left with his family without even locking his door. In fact, his door was ajar. We went to inspect his house with him. It was exactly how he'd left it. Nothing had been touched at all. We became worried. What had scared off the thieves so that they'd stopped coming? Well, after this, word started to get around that the thieves had gone for good, and many of our other neighbors began to return. Things slowly began to get back to normal. One night, before I was about to go to sleep, I looked out the window for a while. I looked at John's house across from us, and for a split second, I could see what looked like a shadow, and it scared me. Had the thieves returned again? I told my dad what I'd seen, and all of a sudden everyone gathered by the window to look out. My dad went to get his shovel, as he told us to stay inside and lock the door. He ran to John's house and knocked, and John came outside. They talked shortly, and he went back inside and got a coat along with a shovel. My dad ran back to the house as we opened it, and he said we would go out with the neighbors to see if the thieves had returned. That night, my dad and some of our neighbors, including John, went out to see if the thieves were around. After an hour or two, the men came back, but the sight of them walking through the streets and near the other houses had alarmed the other neighbors, so they all came out to see as well. And they asked the men if the robbers had returned. Well, they could only reply that someone had seen something, and they were seeing if something really was there. Finally, my dad came back. It had been a false alarm, but none of us slept very well that night. After that night, things really did seem to go back to normal, but I wondered for how long. In order to calm my nerves, I usually like to head towards a small park, not too far away from here, by bike using the highway. We were told by the police not to do it, and they'd even threatened to take our bikes, but we didn't care. The highway was our only link to the outside world, so we took it to get where we needed to go. Now, on this particular day, I rode my bicycle to a park about an hour away in another town using the highway. In this town there was a park with a small lake that I would go to relax. I stayed there for a few hours, bathing in the sun and watching the water sparkle. After a while, I decided to head back home. As usual, I took the highway back, careful to avoid cars, and passed through our rough gravel road as usual. It had become dark now, so I got off the bike and walked to our shed. We had quite a large shed where we stored various farm tools. When I entered, I put the bike inside, and then I heard a sound. It wasn't the first time I'd heard a sound in there. I mean, we'd found a rat inside once. I looked around. The shed had two rooms, so I looked at the other room. I saw what seemed like a face peeking through the doorway inside. I was frozen in fear. I was trying to make sense of what I was looking at. Was it a person? I looked, but there's no way it could have been human. Then it moved out of the doorway, and I could see more of its body. It was completely black and hairless. It looked almost like a human, but it wasn't. Its face was absolutely disturbing. It had a white outline that made its face appear like a mask, and it had what looked like two short horn-like crests on its head that were white and rounded with a pointy tip. Immediately, as it stepped out of the doorway, something inside me told me to look away and stay still. I immediately looked away. The second part of the instructions were quite pointless, as I was frozen stiff. The thing approached me. It moved in an unnatural spider-like motion. I could see in my peripheral vision it was looking at me. It had disproportionately long, thin limbs. I could see its hands had long fingers and long claws. It reminded me a lot of the rake creature. It stayed there, looking at me. It moved to the side where I was facing, so it could look me in the face. But I looked away again. As I looked away, I noticed what looked like a smile on its face. Oh, it was a super creepy smile. I could even see its sharp teeth. My guess is, well, it wasn't smiling. It was just showing its teeth. Something I'd learned in various nature documentaries. A sign of aggression in animals. I could still see it from my peripheral vision as it closed its mouth and walked around me in that awful, hideous, all fours movement. I was even more scared now because I couldn't see what it was doing at all. I could hear that voice in my head again. No matter what happens, don't move a muscle. That's when I heard the most god-awful scream ever. But I remained still, though trembling uncontrollably, as it got in front of me, but this time it was on two legs, and its mouth was open. It was about my height, and looking me in the face. I looked away again, but I was shaking badly, as I used every inch of my being to try not to move. It kept constantly moving to look at my face, but I looked away every time. A sudden sound of metal dropping on the floor made it look behind me, and then it moved in lightning-fast motion. I didn't know if I should look around, but all of a sudden I felt a hand on my shoulder. "Why are you waiting here in the dark?" asked my dad. I was so relieved as I turned around and hugged him. By then I'd turned into a blubbering mass of jelly, and I was shaking uncontrollably. I was tearing up. My nose was running. I think I may even have peed myself. Dad was confused. He asked what was wrong. I didn't say a word, but I didn't sleep at all that night. I eventually fell asleep in the morning and woke up later in the day. I remembered that face and that smile, if you can call it a smile. I knew now why the thieves had run away. I stayed there thinking about what had happened. And it made sense now why the thieves had not returned. This thing was a nightmare. That day I asked my dad if he could get me some sleeping pills when he headed into town. He asked why. Well, I just said I couldn't sleep. He said that I don't need them, but I pleaded with him, and finally he agreed. That night I took two of them, and after a few minutes I was out. I woke up the next day with a horrible grogginess and a weird taste in my mouth. I got up slowly to get a glass of water. And then I remembered that creature again, and I felt a cold sweat on me as my hand shook. What was it? Was it a rake? The only thing I could think to call it was a black rake. Oh, this horrible thing had an identity in my mind. The Blake. I figure the more I know about it, the less power it would have over me. I looked around and noticed no one was inside. I called out to everyone, but no one was home. After a little bit, I went outside. I could see a way off. There was a crowd of people. They seemed very upset. I went close to see what had happened. I could see what looked like the police chief on the ground, bloody, and his clothes ripped as he was being abused by the crowd there. I asked one of the older neighbors, Mark, what had happened. He said that the thieves had come back again last night and asked if I'd heard it. I told him I was asleep. Oh, I don't know how you could sleep with all that commotion last night, he replied. What exactly happened? I asked. He said that the thieves had returned again last night, but then they started hearing some horrendous screams and gunshots. When the shots stopped, people got out of their homes to see what had happened, and they saw this hideous creature attacking one of the thieves. The men managed to scare the creature away, but when they took the man's mask off, it had been a police officer. Even worse, his friends left him to die while they all ran away, said Mark. The people in the village contacted the investigative journalist again, and he came right away. This story was not one he was going to miss. As to the creature that had attacked the thieves, it was passed off as a bear, but people in our village knew exactly what it was. One of the farmers, Peter, had even remembered days before the thieves arrived that many of his animals were going missing without explanation, and he thought that maybe it was a fox or a jackal. My dad even remembered the night when he'd found me in the shed shaking, and now realize why. Ever since then, my perspective on this creature has changed. I don't think this creature is evil, but then again, neither is a tiger, but that hasn't stopped them from killing people. It only acted defensively, and I think it was only gauging if I was a real threat at the shed. Now it seems to me that our prayers were answered in getting rid of the thieves. Help did arrive, only from the most unlikely of sources.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by Walden University. Ever catch yourself thinking, what if I could go after what I actually want and really make a difference? You're not alone, and that's exactly why I want to tell you about Walden University. For over 50 years, Walden has helped working adults like you get the W with the knowledge and skills to build the future you want and make a difference where it matters most. If you've been waiting for the right moment, this is it. Head to waldenu.edu and take that first step. Walden University, set a course for change, certified to operate by Chev.
Our third tale of terror this evening is, have you ever heard of the Childhood Psychopathy Diagnostic Observation Scale by Queasy Panda?
Have you ever heard of the Childhood Psychopathy Diagnostic Observation Scale? No. Of course, you haven't. I don't mean to belittle you. It's due to the nature of the CPDOS that you haven't heard of it. No one has. Except for the select few government agencies who saw the true beauty, the true value the measure has to society. It really only involves a couple of buttons, a couple of marshmallows, and an excellent guide to measure the Machiavellian nature of the world's preterm psychopaths. Well, enough of the abstractions. Let's get to it, eh? There are about 3 million psychopaths in the United States. Psychopaths are your lawyers, your parents, your bankers. They're everywhere, and the intelligent ones blend into society with little friction. Most of these people are either pacifistic or not intelligent enough to cause any real damage to our society. It's the lottery winners of intelligence and the genetic and environmental contributors to violent psychopathy that we need to worry about. This toxic personality cocktail produces the Charlie Mansons and Jeff Dahmers of this world. And that's where I come in. I began developing the CPDOS during my PhD dissertation. I studied predictors for psychopathy in early childhood. The logic is simple. If we can identify predictors to violent psychopathy, we can nip them in the bud and have a safer society. Now, I'll spare you the literature review and statistical analyses and skip right to the discussion. The study was immensely successful. We found that 90% of our 7-year-olds fitting our criteria for at risk grew up to be violent and intelligent teenagers and adults. These are the ones who got away. After my success, I vowed to never let it happen again. The procedure is painfully simple. I was almost surprised I achieved the level of significance I did. All we used was a bag of buttons and a carefully constructed observational structure masquerading as a game for children. There were 15 children in each classroom, and 15 buttons provided. We said each button was worth a marshmallow. Calling it money helped them understand. We left them alone in the cafeteria for 10 minutes and gave them one simple sentence. A button is worth one marshmallow. We videotaped and audio-bugged the room. A kid deemed high risk gathered at least 12 buttons, scored high on our IQ test, and used violent and eloquently worded, well, for a 7-year-old, threats to gather the buttons. In most classrooms, each child finished the 10 minutes with a button each. Simple, right? 15 buttons, 15 children. The math is simple, even by 7-year-old standards. It was the depraved little bastards we euphemistically referred to as high risk who grew up to skin lost animals and, well, worse. Science is weird like that. Violent threats plus intelligence plus 12 or more marshmallows, and we have a little psychopathic sprout. My to-be publication never made it past the peer review stage. I got a rejection letter for it having, well, potentially dangerous implications. A month after my first sample of at-risk children turned 20, I was contacted by a member of the CIA. Now, at this point, I'd given up on the CPDOS. I'd been teaching in psychology at a local community college. I was given an address and told to bring my notes on the measure. Well, I jumped at the opportunity to converse about my research. Have you ever met a doctor of psychology? Well, I found myself sitting at a round kitchen table of a middle-class colonial with two badged men. They weren't gigantic, clean-cut men with black suits. Instead, I found myself opposite two average-sized men wearing flannels and jeans. Outside of the briefcase and ID badge I requested to see, they looked overwhelmingly average, perhaps by design. After we exchanged pleasantries, the shorter of the two agents passed me a manila folder with a 20-year-old's face on the cover. Now, for confidentiality's sake, we'll call this young adult Ryan. Believe me when I say, you'll be thankful I'm keeping this brief. By the age of 20, Ryan was wanted for the rapes and murders of 3 women in his area, and those are only the reported ones. He's been on the run for 6 months, and there are no leads to his whereabouts. 13 buttons. Justin, 20, has been characterized as an attractive, clever, and charismatic person. Murdered his parents and girlfriend. 12 buttons. Wade, 21, is antisocial, yet has been constantly hailed as a musical prodigy, and piano was his trade. Well, he traded his piano for the execution-style killings of his high school bullies. 15 buttons. Call me apathetic, call me cold, but most importantly, call me correct. I wasn't bewildered by the results. In fact, they made perfect sense. I'd narrowed down the characteristic predictors of psychopathy and operationalized them into a behavioral measure. Well, the list went on. 8 more people, nominally tied to heinous crimes. It wasn't perfect, though, as science rarely is. On the list, there was one name that didn't fit the bill. Kevin, 20, was in the midst of his public health degree, 3.98 GPA, and at an Ivy League. He has plans to enroll in the Peace Corps and improve the lives of those less fortunate than him. This fucker hasn't had as much as a parking violation, let alone any relation to a violent crime. 14 goddamn buttons. Now, in most other circumstances, I'd go down in history as one of the most influential psychologists of all time. But these were not average circumstances. Due to Kevin's existence and the CIA's hell-bent rhetoric, I ended up trading my fame and mark in history for anonymity and a pretty annual penny. The agents offered me a 7-figure salary for my work, and my silence. my assistants and I would spend the next 10 years practicing my trade across the country. Stench of rectangular pizzas and chocolate milk burnt into my nasal passages as I travelled elementary school to elementary school, administering the CPDOS. If anything, it was perfect preparation for parenthood. I have a low-maintenance job, plenty of money, and all the knowledge in the world on how to raise a wonderful son. I named him Kevin. I do this for a living. They knew I'd catch on to them. I've kept close tabs on every high-risk child throughout the past 10 years. Sure enough, like clockwork, each one serendipitously disappearing weeks after the measure. It was genius, really. I was the only one taking statistics on how many buttons each child would walk away with, and the categorization of an at-risk child was less than 0.5%. 99% of the time, each child would walk away with a button, a marshmallow, and their life. My silent inquisition of these prematurely psychopathic children was a blistering success. Over the past 10 years, there have been 54 mysterious disappearances of clever, intelligent children. A minuscule price our country has to pay in exchange for the murders of young women and parents. Abduction rates hardly increased, and violent crime rates impactfully decreased. So, why the hell am I telling you all of this? I need advice. Trust me when I say the irony of a psychologist seeking advice isn't lost on me. Call it karma. Call it my payment to the 54 souls, 10% of which were likely bound to be innocent, that I robbed of their lives, but I find myself in a predicament. Should I run? Double down on my philosophy and let the system work its magic. There I was, doing household chores after a long day in an elementary school 30 minutes from my house. It was Friday, and time for the house's weekly deep clean and upkeep. I finally got to Kevin's laundry. In the back pocket of his warm blue jeans, there they sat. 13 buttons.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by Walden University. Ever catch yourself thinking, what if I could go after what I actually want and really make a difference? You're not alone, and that's exactly why I want to tell you about Walden University. For over 50 years, Walden has helped working adults like you get the W with the knowledge and skills to build the future you want and make a difference where it matters most. If you've been waiting for the right moment, this is it. Head to waldenu.edu and take that first step. Walden University. Set a course for change. Certified to operate by Chev.
Our penultimate story this evening is The Doll by Una Cum Machina.
I recently had an odd experience. When I told my friends, most of them thought I was straight up crazy. This happened late this summer. I'd woken up at about 5:50 a.m. on a Saturday. I knew I couldn't get back to sleep. There was just too much crap on my mind. It had been a really long week at work with a lot of stress, and I'd had some, well, shall we say, friction with my girl. So I went out for a drive to clear my head. Can't speak to those of you outside the Rockies, but if you live near the mountains, let me tell you, there's nothing quite like blasting some tunes and driving the mountains in good weather. So, after minimal consideration, I threw on some metal and set off for a drive. It's actually really what I needed. A great start for the day. I got most of the way to Estes Park before I turned around and headed back home. Oh, the mountains were beautiful. The air was clean and crisp, especially for a July day. With the beautiful scenery, the music and RPMs really got the stress worked out. Sometimes just getting out and letting the miles peel by is exactly the kind of catharsis that you need. The drive got me pretty centered, and when I was back in the suburbs, I'd switched to some less intense music. It was Nightwish, I'm pretty sure. I was just kind of cruising along, not really headed back to the house in any specific way yet, just rather winding down after the drive. When I got back to the general area I lived in, and gotten off the main thoroughfares, I noticed there was a set of signs leading to a yard sale, and decided to go check it out on a whim. I honestly don't remember quite which neighborhood I wound up in when I stopped for the yard sale. Oh, I swear to God I wish I did. If I did, I could go back and ask some questions, but it's funny how memory works, though. Well, you know, in that Soviet Union, not everyone gets dark humor, just like food, kind of way. Anyway, I stopped on the opposite side of the street from the yard sale, too close to a fire hydrant. That much I remember, for whatever it's worth. I got out of the car and strolled casually across the street. The yard sale itself was vaguely disappointing. Mostly porcelain chokes, clothes that went out of fashion in the 80s, and bad replicas of boring paintings. However, I was looking for something to buy. I wanted to scratch a whim, if you know what I mean. After a couple of laps around the sale, I noticed something that had passed my attention previously. It was a rag doll. Long black strands of yarn for hair. One red button and one black button for eyes, and a kind of Wednesday Addams dress. It also had one of those name tag stickers with Yvette scrawled across it in broken crayon print. Well, it was super creepy. I couldn't imagine that it was supposed to be anything else. That being said, certainly had personality, and was on the cheap. So, lacking interest in any other options of things to buy, and kind of taken by the nobody-loves-me charm of the doll, I threw down the $3 they were asking for and carted my loot back to the car. On the drive back, I remember thinking, well, now that I bought it, what should I do with it? With no real answer in mind. Sadly, throw it in a dumpster fire didn't come to mind. Regardless, I got home, carted it inside, and kind of tossed it aside on the little circular table in the dining room niche off the side of the kitchen. It slid to a rest near the edge of the table, and probably would have remained there for some unspecified number of weeks before I decided to do something with it. Well, when I say probably, I mean certainly, but that's besides the point. However, it wasn't left up to my bad housekeeping habits to dictate, which is why I am here. Anyway, after discarding the doll on the table, I moved on to a more important matter, specifically lunch. I have no idea what I had for lunch specifically. Probably a sandwich, and quite likely chips. Well, very likely chips. I have a particular weakness for barbecue-flavored Lays. After I'd wrapped up lunch, I was washing the plate in the kitchen sink along with a few other things that had been sitting there. Washing dishes is kind of a mechanical task for me, and I was staring blankly out of the window in the kitchen. Not really looking at anything in particular, just zoning. My phone was in the living room, playing tunes from my playlist, loud enough to hear, but not quite loud enough to drown out the monotone hum of the AC. I probably wouldn't remember that any more than I remember lunch, but there was an oddity that occurred that made it stand out in my memory. Really, the entirety of the rest of the afternoon was strange enough. It's pretty cemented in my memory. But this was where it really started to stand out for me. I saw a SWAT van pass by, followed by what appeared to be a Benz S-Class, followed by a second SWAT van. I remember I stopped, hands submerged up to my wrist in a glass, my dead-eye gaze replaced with one of notable curiosity. I craned my neck to see if I could figure out where they were going through the dense trees. I don't know if there's anywhere where that would be a normal sight, but it was absolutely bizarre in my area. I live in a relatively secluded neighborhood that has plenty of land and plenty of trees. It's a good place to live. I couldn't imagine what would have needed not only one, but two SWAT vans. I mean, there's houses worth plenty more than mine further down the road, and money can equal trouble, but I don't think anyone has quite that much money in this neighborhood. Alternatively, they could have just been passing through, but it's enough of a detour to get anywhere useful. I couldn't imagine why they'd do it. Anyway, after pondering that for a couple of minutes, put my hand out of the cup and went back to actually trying to clean it. The next big event of the day happened only a few minutes later. I'd finished washing the dishes and had moved on to rinsing them and stacking them in the rack to dry. I was about half done with that process when I heard a loud thudding at the front door, immediately accompanied by a commanding voice shouting,
"Police, open up."
I'll be honest, my first reaction was, what the hell? I mean, I'd seen SWAT drive by, so I should have consciously been aware of what was happening, but it seemed so outlandish to me to have the police at my door that it just didn't click. Honestly, it took me a moment to get my brain into working order enough to even realize I should probably respond. I was 3/4 of the way to the door when they started pounding and yelling again. I was half afraid to open the door, but I figured that they sounded kind of, well, sort of a little bit agitated, and leaving them to sit on the front stoop was unlikely to improve their attitudes, so I decided the best thing to do was to open the door. The rest of my day was, well, shall we say, a right proper cluster. However, if those SWAT officers were wearing body cameras, I really want the footage of when I opened the door. Not saying this was a pleasant experience by any means, and I wouldn't want to go through it again, but I bet my expression was worth $1 million. The police were in full blacked-out armor, shotguns and M16s, and standing in the middle of them was a fellow who was apparently a priest, in long flowing robes, a tall funny hat, and, I swear, what appeared to be white body armor with red and gold trim. He was flanked on both sides by fellows who I assume were lesser members of the clergy, as their robes were less flowy, their bulletproof vests less ornate, and they were holding these incense censers. No joke. So, honestly speaking, I couldn't have given you a half a reason why SWAT would have been at my door, much less SWAT plus the bizarre combat cleric and his minions. I'm sure my face was the very picture of confusion. Anyway, I very rapidly found myself face down on the ground, with a bunch of heavily armored men in my front hall and a boisterous cleric liberally spritzing everything with what I can only assume was holy water, and loudly demanding I tell him where the hell form was. The entire time, the two minion priests were swinging the incense things and chanting in Latin, or at least I assume it was Latin. I didn't understand it, but really had other things on my mind and wasn't paying so much attention to them as to identify the language they were speaking. What I'd like to say, I remained calm and tried to rationally tell them I had no idea what they were talking about. That would be a lie. I was mostly incomprehensible. I was stuttering so badly and tripping over my words so much. I suppose that will happen to you when you've got that many guys with that many big barrel guns that and who are that upset that you're not complying with their demands. The long and the short of it was, they were wanting information I didn't understand, and they didn't understand me in return because I wasn't particularly coherent. Good times to be had all around. If the problem hadn't more or less resolved itself, I'm not sure how everything would have turned out in the end. That aside, after what was probably a couple of minutes of their interrogation, one of them, a fellow carrying a shotgun, for whatever that's worth, shouted out,
"Target located! Target located!"
Considering he was just standing a few feet away from us, in the kitchen, I'm not sure why he felt the need to yell, but he wasn't asking for my opinion anyhow. The bulk of them then rushed into the dining room portion of the kitchen, leveled their weapons at the table, and started screaming things like,
"Don't resist," or "On the ground."
I couldn't see clearly what was going on from my vantage point on the ground, but it seemed as though the table had offended them greatly. Or at least, that's how it appeared to my adrenaline and fear-addled brain. I'm pretty sure that I yelled at them, telling them to leave my table alone, probably yelling at them to leave my table alone with some particularly colourful and spicy metaphors mixed in. Regardless, they ignored me. The battle bishop and his incense-spewing bodyguards advanced as well. When he started in with what I can only assume was a Latin ministration of some sort, and started aggressively splashing my dining room table with holy water, what might be the strangest thing of the entire day occurred. The room got cold. I mean, like, I could see my breath. Also, it got dark. Not nighttime dark, but more like overcast it might rain kind of day dark. Also, a distinct smell, like rot, started up. One of my friends had me smell rotting eggs, which apparently he let go bad for this express purpose. Well, when I identified them as the same smell, he let me know it was brimstone or sulfur. So, yeah, I'm sure all of this is terribly cliche, but what can I say? That's how it played out. Anyway, that all happened and, well, I'd thought the SWAT dudes were agitated before. They kicked it up several levels. There was a lot of screaming and swearing. Honestly, though, that didn't seem to help much. The temperature kept decreasing. It kept getting darker, and the smell got stronger. It started mixing with the smell of burnt ozone. Then the priest kicked it up a notch, too. He started belting out his mantra at a volume and intensity that would have made a South American soccer announcer proud. His two minions were responding back to his mandates with very nearly the same intensity. Then he pulled out what appeared to be a glass vial of holy water, smashed it on the table and dropped to his knees, thundering out such rapid-fire strings of Latin, I'd say he'd have had to have been fluent. His litany built into a frankly impressive crescendo, and then finished. Everything went quiet for about 30 seconds. Then the police again started screaming for the table to drop to the floor. Then, well, in a movie I might think this would have been obvious, but honestly I wasn't meta-analyzing anything at that exact moment in life. So, yeah, the doll fell off the table. Basically, as soon as it started falling, it got warmer and brighter in the room, and the room went back to smelling heavily of incense instead of rot and ozone. Then one of the SWAT guys grabs the doll, stuffs it in a burlap sack that has crosses and Bible verses spray-painted on it, and a lot of them double-time it out of my house and speed off into the afternoon. I laid on the floor for a while, not finding that I had the energy to try and get back up. After a while, I gathered enough gumption to migrate to the living room. I sat down on the couch, contemplating the merits of getting blackout drunk, in the hopes that I'd forget the events of the day, when there was again a knocking at my door. I shuffled over to the door like some shell-shocked zombie and opened it to find a man with a really nice suit, really nice watch, perfect haircut, and a G-Series license plate on his car, was standing at my door. It was at that point where I did either the most sensible thing I did that day, or least sensible thing, and I slammed the door in his face. He stood there, and not for a while longer, and I ostensibly ignored him while pouring myself a drink or three. So, anyway, that's my story. If anyone out there has any ideas about what happened, or what a hell form is, or whether there is anything I can do about the fact I'm now noticing I'm being tailed by blacked-out vehicles with G-Series plates. Well, I'm all ears.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by Walden University. Ever catch yourself thinking, what if I could go after what I actually want and really make a difference? You're not alone, and that's exactly why I want to tell you about Walden University. For over 50 years, Walden has helped working adults like you get the W, with the knowledge and skills to build the future you want and make a difference where it matters most. If you've been waiting for the right moment, this is it. Head to waldenu.edu and take that first step. Walden University, set a course for change, certified to operate by CHEV.
We round off tonight's proceedings with I found a box of letters in my dead parents' house by Logan966. I've spent all my life in Birmingham. Here, even the people are haunted. Sometimes I'm wondering what I'm doing with my life, whether I should leave and get a new change of scenery, or stay and try to get my life back together. My parents died recently. They were on a plane to Italy on vacation. Their plane crashed, and everyone on board died. It wasn't pilot error like everyone in the media would like you to believe. Black box audio is usually public, but the audio for Birmingham Airlines Flight 1357 was never released and kept from the public. Of course, the theories came flooding in like water through a broken dam. Despite the best efforts of the government to sweep this under the rug, I and the families of everyone else who died on board demanded answers. We got none, until the audio was leaked. That only brought up more unanswered questions. I listened to the audio myself. The pilots were just having an ordinary conversation. Then they both noticed something. The audio went dead silent, and the two pilots started confessing all their wrongdoings. Everything they'd ever done spewed out of their mouths. The rest of the recording was just everyone screaming. I decided to move on and not dwell on any theories that other people on the internet came up with. It didn't really matter either way. My parents were dead. I had a mock funeral. I was the only one who went. Seeing that we had no other family, it was up to me to get their house cleaned up and ready to sell. I wasn't looking forward to the probate process. One day I drove over there. The house was a poor facsimile of what it used to be. What was once a lush, well-kept lawn was now overgrown with yellow grass. Thankfully, the house and second garage across from it was made of brick. I feared to imagine what shape they'd be in if they hadn't been built with brick. As I walked up the pathway to the front door, memories flashed through my mind like lightning. Me and Dad tossing the ball when I was 10. Me walking the dog around the house with Mum when I was 12. The memories faded and reality sunk in. I'd never be able to make memories with them again. I was over everything up until this point. My knees buckled and I dropped to the ground. Tears streamed down my face and I couldn't control it anymore. They were gone forever, and nothing could change that. I took a few deep breaths and counted to 10. After my breathing exercises, I felt right as rain. I picked myself up off the floor and entered the house. It was eerie being in the house for the first time in years. The inside of the house didn't look abandoned, and part of me felt like Mum and Dad were still in their bedroom or living room. It was like being inside one of those houses in Chernobyl. Everything in the house looking the same as it did the day it was abandoned. Canned food and box food was still in the cabinets. Mouse droppings laid on the floor. The smell of mold and mildew was so strong I could almost taste it. I held my breath and trudged forward to the bedrooms to look for my parents' financial information. After a few minutes of rummaging through their bedroom, I found the paperwork. Also, I found something else. A box of letters that I'd never seen before, written by people I've never met. Letter 1. Dear Uncle Tony, November 14th, 1989. Happy birthday, Uncle Tony. Love is not something you can see. Love is something you can feel deep in your heart. And I love you. Love, Lorraine. Really strange. The letter is addressing my father, but he and my mother didn't have any siblings. Why lie? Did he have a falling out, and as a result he didn't want anything else to do with his family? Letter 2. Dear Uncle Tony, November 21st, 1989. I really like staying over and spending time with you and Aunt Pam. I love staying up past my bedtime to watch cartoons and eat chocolate chip cookies. At night, it really scares me when I hear tapping on my window. I cover myself with my blanket and turn over, but the tapping just continues. Lorraine. Letter 3. Dear Uncle Tony, November 28th, 1989. I had lots of fun building snow forts with you and Aunt Pam last weekend. I had more fun when I caught the both of you by surprise and nailed you with snowballs. It was fun until bedtime. The tapping started again, and this time I couldn't help but turn over, and I saw a monster at my window. I started feeling really guilty and sad as I stared at him. There was something mesmerizing about that thing at the window. Unable to look away, I started remembering all sorts of bad stuff I did, like breaking Mom's vase and lying about it. I smashed my head against the hall pillow to make the thought stop. Lorraine. Letter 4. To Tony, December 4th, 1989. I'm happy to let Lorraine spend the weekend over your house. You're family after all, and I want her to know her aunt and uncle. You and Pam have really been there for Lorraine, and ever since Rick abandoned us a few years ago, well. But Lorraine came home on Sunday with a bruise on her forehead. Please make sure you keep an eye on her when she's playing. Susan. Letter 5. Dear Uncle Tony, December 8th, 1989. I'm really looking forward to spending Xmas with you. Thank you for buying me a Barbie. I love her so much. I played with her until that monster showed up. I saw him again and started feeling guilty like last time. And I remembered when I taught a kid at school yellow snow was the same as a yellow snow cone, and he ate it. I smashed my head again, and this time it really hurt. Lorraine. Letter 6. Dear Pam, December 18th, 1989. For whatever reason, Tony hasn't bothered to listen to me. I'm looking forward to having Xmas with you, but Lorraine got a bigger bruise on her forehead. How is she getting hurt so much? Susan. Letter 7. Dear Pam, January 1st, 1990. I really appreciate you and Tony having us over for the holidays, but there's something really odd that happened when I was there. I was awakened by a knock on my door. Lorraine was crying and telling me that someone was tapping on her window. I walked into the room she was staying in. At first, I thought there was something at the window, but chalked it up to my imagination since I was still half asleep. Clearly, I have not been listened to. I don't think I can allow her over your house if you continue not to listen. I'll allow you both one more chance. I don't want to have to do this, but if you force my hand, I'll do what I feel is best. Susan. Letter 8. Dear Uncle Tony, January 4th, 1990. I really enjoy seeing you and Aunt Pam. I don't know if I want to come over anymore. I couldn't sleep last time. I'm really scared to go over. Lorraine. Letter 9. Dear Tony and Pam, January 7th, 1990. I cannot allow Lorraine at your house. When she got home from the last visit, she said she never wanted to go back and wouldn't stop crying. I don't know what happened, but she's not going to your home anymore. I'm furious that my rules were not obeyed. How dare you undermine me? I think you know how Lorraine got hurt too, but I'm starting to think it wasn't just an accident due to your negligence. Susan. Letter 10. Dear Tony and Pam, February 1st, 1990. How dare you try and play the victim? You want me to reconsider? No way. If you guys didn't hurt Lorraine, then how come you can't at the very least admit that both of you are negligent caretakers? How dare you throw in my face all the things you did for Lorraine financially, emotionally, or otherwise? Don't try to spin me a sob story. Oh, Lorraine is the daughter I'll never have. Cry me a river. Also, never throw my condition in my face again. I've been just fine mentally, and I've been taking my medicine. My illness has nothing to do with the decision I'm making. I laughed when I read the part of your letter when you mentioned you were afraid for the child's well-being because I'm unwell. Don't ever threaten me. You'll never see Lorraine or me again as long as you live. It looked to be the end of the letters. I needed answers, so I searched the house for any more letters, but found nothing. And, well, I gave up. Feeling defeated, I gathered myself and grabbed the paperwork I needed and then headed home. During the ride home, I felt like something was following me. Well, I ascribed the feeling to just being on edge due to the letters. I pulled into the driveway of my home, feeling empty. My house was a mess. Not as bad as my parents' house, but still a mess. The lawn was unkempt. White peeling paint on the front porch and on either side of the house indicated that a new paint job was needed. It's not like it really mattered anyway. No one was going to come visit me. I was alone. The mailbox was overflowing with a thick stack of mail. I removed the mail, then headed inside. A few days' worth of dishes were piled in the sink. Also, the trash can was crammed full with fast food bags. Ever since the death of my parents, I've been barely taking care of myself. I threw my letters down on the table, nothing but bills and junk mail. There was nothing to look forward to anymore. I dragged myself to bed and laid down. As my eyelids became heavier, I was about to drift off to sleep. I had the feeling that someone was watching me. I heard an ominous tapping on my window, but didn't dare turn over to see what was causing the noise. And there we have it, the end of another visit to Dr. Creepin's dungeon. Now, if you enjoyed tonight's stories, do me one small favor. Leave a nice review and a 5-star rating wherever you get your podcasts. That's it for this week, but I'll be back again next week, same time, same place. Until then, sweet dreams and bye-bye.